listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now let's set the scene. An eccentric rich guy shakes up the world with a big announcement at a press conference.
I'm just not the hero type, clearly, with this laundry list of character defects, all the mistakes I made, largely public. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Truth is, I am Iron Man.
Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark in the original Iron Man movie. That announcement ends the movie and begins one of the biggest pop culture franchises ever, the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Spanning a few dozen-ish movies and counting, plus some TV series too, sort of, Marvel superheroes live in a shared universe and a developing plotline that's dominated pop culture, made tons of money, and influenced other creators. And our next guests say the Marvel Cinematic Universe is packed with political messages that reflect the culture of their time and can influence it in turn. They've edited a new book tracing some of those messages. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts about the political and social messages that you've seen in a superhero movie or show or a comic book? Or are you going to superhero stories to get away from all that stuff? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Our guests are the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Nicholas Carnes is a professor of public policy at Duke University. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
And Lily J. Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University in Waukesha. Lily, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on today, Rob.
Lily, let's start with you. If we want to learn about our political world, why turn to pop culture?
I've long studied popular culture, and popular culture often reflects back the realities of our lived experiences in so many different kinds of messages and in so many different kinds of presentations and representations. And so while popular culture, be it televisual or cinematic or video games or music, are also forms of entertainment and capitalism. They also talk to us a lot about who we are and what we do.
Okay, Nick, why the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
Well, I focus on just the sheer scope of it. I mean, we're up to 30 films, 9 Disney Plus shows. And, you know, films are regularly making close to or more than $1 billion at the box office. So part of the appeal of studying this sort of entertainment franchise is just the sheer number of people watching it and thinking about it. And as a political scientist, that's a site where I really want to know, okay, what are the messages? What are the political messages it's sending?
And Lily, is there something inherent in a superhero story? You talk about this, I think it was in the introduction the two of you wrote to the book, that there are big problems that only amazing individuals can save us from.
Yeah, I mean, superheroes occupy a space that is one that is generally not, quote, democratically, small d, democratically elected. So they operate usually outside of a governmental system, which can be somewhat problematic. And then we look to them to solve problems that we ourselves cannot get ourselves to solve with their superhero capacities. And that perhaps gives us, unfortunately, the out of never being able to solve other problems that we face on the regular basis, because we always want superheroes to solve those problems.
And Nick, looking at the different pieces in your book, the different Marvel movies, if we're going in looking for one political message, we might be in trouble. There's so much variety here. You and the authors of pieces in your book, it seems like they found a pretty wide variety of messages, sometimes even conflicting with each other.
That's right. And that's why this volume is sort of drawing on more than 30 political scientists' expertise on a wide range of topics, because when you have so many films with so many different creative teams, there's actually a lot of variety, and there's no one sort of single message that I think is coming out of this cinematic franchise. So we really need it. I mean, when Lily and I sort of started working on this project, I think we realized really early on it had to be a big team effort to even, you know, sort of scratch the surface at understanding of, you know, what's going on in this huge amount of cinema and pop culture text.
We're talking to political scientists Nicholas Carnes and Lily Gorin, co-editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see political or social messages coming through? Do you think they're on purpose or accidental? Do you like those messages when you're going to see that big Marvel blockbuster or the TV show? Or if you're reading the comics, the book doesn't go there, but you can. 800-642-1234 is the number. Jake joins us now in Appleton. Jake, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. I just want to say that I'll argue that I don't believe there's political messaging in this, simply because I don't believe political messaging is a big draw for movie and theater appreciation or just people who enjoy cinema. And I'm sure we could look at older movies like The Wizard of Oz and things like The Lion King and probably find similarities to political messaging, simply because the last 5-6 years has been extremely deep in like exposure, like I more in my lifetime than I remember. So that's my comment on it.
Jake, thanks for the call. And Lily, maybe we're going to these movies for escapism. If there are political messages in there, they just kind of wash over us because we're there for the story of the special effects.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that we're not necessarily talking about a writing team or a directing or producing team that sits down and say, we want to communicate this particular right. message. But messages are communicated. And there are lots of different kinds of messages that are communicated about race, about gender, about sexuality, about power, about governmental structures, about the military. And so, again, it's not necessarily that there is a finely crafted message that is the narrative, but the narrative does communicate a variety of political messages.
Jake, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. I wanted to get into some for instances and check out the chapters each of you contributed to this book. Nick, let's start with yours. You tackled the U.S. government appears a lot in these movies and TV shows. You tackled, are they portrayed positively or negatively? How'd you do that briefly? What did you find?
So one of the things I was interested in when we first started thinking about the MCU and what sort of the subtle political messages might be is when the U.S. government is on screen, is it a good guy or a bad guy, right? So there's this idea that Lily referred to that, you know, superheroes kind of solve the problems that governments can't. It wouldn't be a very interesting movie if, you know, a villain showed up and, you know, Congress passed a law and solved it. That might not be what people are looking for when they want to go see a blockbuster. So then the question is, well, okay, so what is government's function in here? Is it sort of a hapless, you know, we can't do anything and the heroes come and save us? Is it potentially an adversary? Is it corrupt? Is it, you know, working against the heroes? And so I worked with a couple of research assistants to actually code every single instance when the U.S. government is represented on screen in all the MCU films in phases 1 through 3. So the first 23, 24 films. And what we found is actually more often than not, government is on the side of the good guys. It's not helpless. It's not evil. More often than not, government is there and working with the heroes. So that's what we mean when we talk about the sort of subtle political messages that we find in these, you know, the there's never sort of a scene where, you know, a hero is saying, oh, government is good or government is bad. But in the background, we're seeing government operate. And I wanted to know, you know, what's the message people are taking away?
And then, Lily, you looked at the role of nostalgia in the Marvel Cinematic Universe versus, you know, the way it's used in the political world now. What kind of things are you looking at?
Well, I was looking at the way that movies themselves are entities that are structured nostalgically. Your experience going to the movie often takes you to a different place that can make you yearn for a different time or experience. And so I was looking at the MCU broadly in terms of what is being presented in this way that would make somebody yearn for another time or a different construction of our current situation. And I found that there is a connection between both nationalism, particularly U.S. nationalism, and a kind of nostalgic yearning for heroics from times gone by. And, you know, Captain America is kind of obviously an embodiment of this because his life spans 100 years or more. But you also see this in some of the other franchises, like in WandaVision, where nostalgic sort of tempos are integrated into the entire series by presenting it as different sort of decades of sitcoms. And so you have a lot of woven into the MCU, a structural nostalgia. And I wanted to sort of think about that and understand that in terms of this whole cinematic universe. Is it just Captain America, or is there more than Captain America in terms of that sort of understanding?
We're talking about big screen superheroes and some of the political and social messages they may send with the editors of the new book, The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily Gorin is a professor of political science at Carroll University. Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have thoughts or questions about political messages, social messages that might show up in superhero pop culture, whether it's on the big screen or small screen or the small page? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Lily Gorin and Nicholas Carnes, political scientist and editors of the new book called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you followed some or all of these movies and TV shows in that Marvel world? Do you see political themes and messages in any superhero stories, print or screen? Do you like those messages? Do they bother you? A little of both sometimes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Michael is with us in Waupun. Michael, hi.
Hi. Enjoying the conversation here. Many years ago, I was able to meet Stan Lee at a comic book convention. I brought my Silver Surfer comic, and he paused, and he looked at it, and he said, "Ah, Silver Surfer, he was always my favorite." And as a little fanboy, as a kid, that just made my day, that like my favorite character was Stan Lee's favorite character.
What is it about Silver Surfer that you and maybe Stan Lee appreciated?
Well, he's a character that sacrificed himself in order to save the planet Earth from the character Galactus, and then he became kind of a herald for him, just kind of searching the universe, looking for planets for him to devour. And it kind of expresses our own humanity and our own, maybe, you know, Galactus couldn't understand why he would do that.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Lily, this is kind of contrary to my point I brought up earlier. We're waiting for the superhero to save us. This is a case, this is a character who hasn't appeared in the Marvel Cinematic Universe yet, I don't think. But a normal person who sacrifices himself with a huge ethical decision. Do you see in some ways superheroes being an inspiration for individual action in the political or social world?
Oh, I would say so. And of course, you do have a number of the MCU superheroes who are not, in fact, gifted with superpowers. Both Iron Man and also Black Widow are straight up human beings. They don't have special powers. And of course, Iron Man is a man in a can. And so he designed it and it does all kinds of stuff. But he is, you know, he is just a human being like the rest of us. And so I do think that there is a dimension, particularly of this understanding of what a hero is and who a hero is. And a couple of our authors really dig at that and sort of put it in context of, you know, how we might each be able to be heroes in particular ways. And what is it that makes a hero? Superheroes have these particular qualities and capacities. But the idea of a hero has much longer legs in a lot of ways.
Michael, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Hope you still have that autograph. That's pretty cool. Nick, we've talked a lot about, I think, U.S. politics and your work looks at the U.S. government in the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies. But and the two of you write about this in your introduction. These are movies where people are hoping to make money all over the world that can lead to some compromises. A location, for example, I think a Doctor Strange movie gets changed from Tibet to Nepal to not offend the Chinese government. How much does the global audience, you think, affect the messages, the choices we see?
Well, I just want to say first, I still have goosebumps from Michael's description of his interaction with Stan Lee.
Yeah,
I'm
cool.
A comic book fan myself and a fan of the genre. So I'm still reeling from that anecdote. I think that's a great example. Moving Kamar-Taj, Doctor Strange's sort of trainings, where Doctor Strange is trained, moving that from Tibet, which it is in the comics, to Nepal, which it is in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is a great example of Marvel Studios and Disney really trying to avoid political controversy. And, you know, our first caller said, you know, I don't see a lot of political messaging in here. I actually think that's not an accident. You know, Disney's trying to appeal to global audiences and to a broad audience here in the U.S., and so they're really trying to stay out of political fights. They you know, sometimes can't help themselves. You know, fans will pressure for, you know, Disney or Marvel Studios for more representation or for less representation. You know, they're going to be accused of being too woke or not progressive or not enough. And I think in this, you know, the sort of capitalist or the sort of market impulse that's driving, you know, a big corporation like Disney is always going to be avoid those controversies when you can. So I think you're going to see that not just internationally, but also in terms of the way they interact with domestic political debates.
Talking to Nick Carnes and Lily Gorin about the new book. They're co-editors of The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Lily, Nick just mentioned issues of representation. That occupies a good chunk of this book, different essays on how representation has changed over the years in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Can you talk about some of the things that the authors bring up?
Yeah, this is a really rich area of discussion in the book. All areas are excellent, but there were just a lot of different contributors who wanted to talk about different aspects of this question of representation. So there's questions of feminism that are explored in a number of places. There's questions of disability and trauma that is explored. There's this really fascinating chapter on how the Avengers are a kind of found family or built family. That was a really fascinating chapter when it first came across our desks and we started reading it. There are, of course, questions about masculinity, because that's so much of what is presented in symbolic ways throughout the MCU. There is a question of the MCU closet and who's still in it and sort of lack of representation in certain regards with regard to the LGBTQ+ community. So all of these different areas are sort of represented in different chapters. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion with regard to race and understanding a place like Wakanda, which is a kind of Afro-futurist paradise, if you will, and, you know, how that sort of stacks up against our understanding of the Black lived experience. So there's all kinds of stuff in there in terms of these many, many, many properties. And, you know, what they are communicating in terms of character development and narrative and symbols and our understanding of ourselves.
Nick, as a comics fan and a political scientist, I imagine you must bring this into the classroom sometimes. How do you talk to your students about how to read a text like a superhero movie and start to look for these kind of messages?
Well, so I sort of take a lot of cues from the, you know, scholars like Lily, who, you know, really have deep expertise on popular culture. I try to convey to students something that I learned from Lily, actually, which is to think about politics not just as elections, campaigns, debates, speeches, but to see politics as, you know, questions about power, representation, and how we live our lives. And once you sort of take that broader perspective on politics, you start to better, you know, see the politics that does exist in popular culture texts like the MCU. And you also better understand why people so often have real world political debates about what occurs in fictional, you know, storytelling. You know, why people will say, I don't like this character being depicted this way. It's because that's really a site where politics is happening, even in fiction, even in superhero stories. So I try to convey that to my students.
Just a few moments left. I'm going to put each of you on the spot and ask for a Marvel Cinematic Universe movie recommendation if somebody's going to see just one. Lily, you get to go first.
Thor Ragnarok.
Okay, easy. Quick line on why.
Because it's hysterically funny, and it really is an interesting exploration of, you know, sort of superheroics. And there are a variety of different sort of nods towards gender and race as well.
And Nick?
I'd have to go with Guardians of the Galaxy, Volume 1 or 2.
Excellent. That is all the time we have. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
Yeah, thanks again.
Been talking to Nicholas Carnes, professor of public policy at Duke University, and Lily Gorin, professor of political science at Carroll University. They're the co-editors of the book we've been talking about. It's called The Politics of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. They both had a quick pick. I like that. No hemming and hawing. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin is infamous for its drinking culture. While some see it as a badge of honor, it does come with health consequences. But long before old fashions and Wisconsin-made beers became our first choices at a happy hour, cocktails and beer were prescribed to us by health practitioners of various sorts, not bartenders. Alcohol has a long history of attempted medicinal use. Our next guest has a new book that traces back through the history of when beer was expected to treat the flu, or brandy could cure malaria, or so people hoped. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the history of alcohol as medicine? Did you have something like this in your family where a little bit of blank was given you for an upset stomach or whatever, maybe when you were a kid even? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Camper English is a cocktails and spirits writer who has contributed to dozens of publications and runs his own bartending blog called Alcademics. He's the author of the new book, Doctors and Distillers, the remarkable medicinal history of beer, wine, spirits, and cocktails. Camper, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the disclaimer. You say this in your book. You're here writing about the history of attempted uses of alcohol as medicine. You are not prescribing these various cures throughout the millennia.
Absolutely not. Talk to your doctor for medicinal issues. If you want a great drink, that's when you go to your bartender.
Excellent. Okay, now let's go back even to the beginning of alcohol, of beer and wine. It was used as kind of a health supplement because when you started to gather lots of people in civilization, we didn't know how to keep drinking water clean. Can you talk about some of those early uses of our beer and our wine?
Sure. There was a great attempts to avoid drinking water from surface water anyway, from rivers and lakes and streams and things like that, all of which today we know is contaminated from microbes. But back then it was just known to be unhealthy. And so the regular drink for people building the pyramids in Egypt, for example, would be beer. You know, it's made from grain, so it has calories and nutritional aspects to it, and some minerals from the fermentation from the yeast. And it was also boiled in the process of making it, very importantly, to kill all those microbes from the water. And when it came to wine, you don't often need to add water in order to ferment wine into its final form, although the Greeks and the Romans liked to water it down, and they considered full-strength wine to be really uncivilized, like taking a swig out of the jug of whiskey today.
And if I'm building a pyramid, I would feel much safer knowing that the people also building the pyramid weren't really drunk. This is pretty low alcohol by volume beer we're talking about, right?
Absolutely. And the grains could be re-fermented a second time. And later in Victorian England and things like that, that was known as small beer, and with probably only 2% ABV or something like that, where the original beer would be still only probably 5% or something. So it wasn't about creating a drunk and docile workforce at all. It was just a healthy, hydrating mineral water of its day.
And you trace from ancient times through medieval and beyond, oftentimes the practice of medicine, such as it was, there was some overlap with the use of alcohol. What stands out to your mind when you think back on what you've written about, you know, how alcohol was used and overlapped with early medicine?
Well, one thing that was a real surprise for me to learn was that distilled alcohol, in particular, was created only in the context of medicine. There was no beverage use designated for it. It was the alchemist, they'd use distillation to try to create the philosopher's stone to turn lead into gold. And similarly, they would use distillation to preserve things like rose water or wormwood water or things like that with water-based medicine. And once the technology got good enough around the year 1200 or so, we see documentation of like, oh no, if you put wine in the still, this is the greatest medicine ever created. We're going to call it the water of life. It's so good. I always thought that was just a superlative term given to brandy because it's so delicious. But it turns out that was speaking to its revivifying and supposedly health-giving properties of distilled alcohol. And for the next 200 years, people just, that's all they could talk about was, this is really, truly the best medicine ever created. And only later do we find evidence of like, hey, probably don't drink so much medicine all at once because it's not going to create a healthy environment for you.
And this overlap, and I didn't really know about this, in the worlds of alchemy, through the worlds of beer brewing, a lot of things we know in medicine now and in chemistry came from those early alchemy experiments or, oh, hey, if we can control these microbes, we can make better beer. Well, there is some health benefit to figure out about those microbes, too. A lot of our modern health came from this.
Yeah, it's fascinating how the actual study of naturally carbonated water led to the understanding that air wasn't one gas, but was made up of several different elemental gases. And then that led to things like understanding individual elements, as well as later to anesthesia and using gases for other purposes. And then specifically with Louis Pasteur, the study of bacteria in wine and beer led to disproving spontaneous generation and directly to the germ theory of disease, one of the most important concepts in medicine, that there are these invisible microbes that spread disease, and it's not the miasma, the swamp gas that was thought to spread disease between person to person. It was actually going to be germs. And then that quickly led to things like anesthetics, antibiotics, and things that kill germ, again, using alcohol as a solution.
Talking to Camper English about his new book, Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Kathleen is with us in Eau Claire. Kathleen, hi.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. What do you want to tell us about, Kathleen?
Well, my family moved to Northern Italy in the early 60s. And at the time, my youngest brother was a baby, was 6 months old. We lived in a hotel for probably 3 or 4 months while my parents were looking for an appropriate place to live. So we had dinner every night in the hotel dining room, in the hotel restaurant, and the baby would be fussy perhaps or crying or something every single night. The waiters would want to give the baby wine. Signora, signora, vino. But no, my mother was not about to do that.
Kathleen, thanks for the call. Vino for the Bambino. Camper, you don't need to go all the way to Italy. This happened in my family. I think a lot of people listening at some point in their family history, this happened. And even you talk about patent medicines and things like that. There was a product called gripe water. for colicky babies. Kathleen's not alone here.
Yeah, there were actually several advertisements, particularly with Italian bitter liqueurs, where they would be recommended specifically for children. They would even contain iron for extra nutrition back when there were a lot of iron deficiencies. But I would say, you know, a spoonful of this alcoholic herbal medicine, maybe whip it up with an egg for your children every night. And it wasn't just for crying, but to infer, to give some medicine to the a daily dose for children. And it's amazing that it was advertised really specifically for that, knowing what we know today.
Thanks a lot for that call. Let's go to Steve now on the line in Stoughton. Steve, hi.
Yeah, good afternoon. Three things that from my personal experience. One, my grandmother always said whiskey on the gums of a teething child. Mm-hmm. And you know, we did it and it worked. The other was they're finding a lot of value of flavonoids, and I like hoppy beer. So hops have a lot of flavonoids. So I continue to think that's a medicinal in use. And then finally, the hot toddy, which I swear by when you're not feeling good with a cold.
Steve, thanks a lot. Wow. Steve hit a lot of stuff in your book there, Capper. Take it where you want to go.
Well, sure. In my family, it was you dip the pacifier in whiskey for the teething kid rather than put it directly on their gums. But for hops are not just a flavoring agent for beer, they're a preservative. And it turns out a lot of spices that we know today, they're all antimicrobial and would do the same thing. Wormwood, which we know from absinthe today, was used at one point just like hops is today. Into the beer. It both makes it taste more bitter, but it also would help it last much longer. And so there are a lot of different healing aspects prescribed to these herbs, but I think the hops is really more there and became more common for its preservative qualities overall. And the hot toddy in the era of the global flu epidemic of 1919, formerly known as the Spanish flu, the doctors would report like we couldn't really help, we couldn't do anything for them, but give them a little bit hot toddy to soothe them at the end. Although often we do find bitters in those hot toddies as well, which would have a lot of stomach soothing properties as well.
Thanks for the call, Steve. And Steve is calling from Stoughton, which made me want to talk to you about bitters because I didn't know this. The first big, I guess, English brand name of bitters was Stoughton Bitters. And these were totally coming from a world of attempted health treatments, right?
Absolutely. It's Stoughton's bitters in particular, which were patented around the very end of the 1700s in England. Those make their way into the original cocktail, which was not the generic name for all mixed drinks, but a specific one that included a dash of medicine in it, Stoughton's bitters. And then that changed forms over the years and became used with other bitters in America. And it was actually a drink meant to soothe the stomach. And it came from the era before ice was common in cocktails. So it was a warm morning hangover drink to soothe the stomach with those medicinal bitters in there. And I can't think of anything less appealing that I would want in the morning.
We're talking to cocktails and spirits writer Capper English about his new book. It's called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you heard claims about medicinal benefits of alcohol? Do you have that family story of using blank alcohol to cure blank condition? Do you have questions for our guest about his work? He goes back millennia up to the present day on this stuff. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Oh, have you ever drunk bitters on a particular bar on a particular island off the coast of Wisconsin? We'll talk about that coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Capper English, cocktails and spirits writer. His new book is called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Monique is with us in Stevens Point. Monique, hi.
Hi, nice to talk to you guys today.
Yeah, what did you want to bring up, Monique?
So my son brews mead. Because my husband and I are local beekeepers, and so we provide him with the local organic honey to make mead. And when he started making it and I became such a huge fan, we did a little bit of research into it, and it turns out that mead was one of the original drinks given for people on their honeymoon for helping make babies.
Huh. All right. Monique, thanks for sharing that. A great family story, growing the, making the honey and making the mead together. Camper, did you run across a mead-related health claims?
Yeah, there are a few throughout different eras in history, because honey, of course, predates sugar as a sweetener in Western Europe and in the United States. And honey in different drinkable forms, particularly with vinegars and things like that, was used for hydrating. And it was also used to cover the bitter flavor, a lot of more medicinal herbs. And so we find it used for a lot of different things over the era, over the eras, or just used as an ingredient in them. But even today, there are honey-based burn treatments because honey is very much antibacterial. That's why it can last for so long without spoiling. And it can use to sort of cover or coat and seal up a wound and help recovery in some ways. And that's used in some over-the-counter burn treatments that you can find online.
Monique, thanks a lot for that call. Great story at 800-642-1234. Now, we were talking about bitters earlier. You referenced in the book called Nelson's Hall and Bitters Club on Washington Island here in Wisconsin. People go there to do shots of bitters often. And part of that story happens during Prohibition, where because it was a medicinal use, they got to keep serving booze, even though most places couldn't. This was not uncommon. There was a lot of prescription alcohol out there?
Oh, absolutely. During Prohibition, the ways that people could drink were either by prescription, and then you could go to your pharmacy and just pick up a bottle of whiskey with your prescription, or medicines that had a base of alcohol, whether they were really trying to treat anything or not, could be purchased over the counter, likely without a prescription. So that's where we find things like bitters were fully available to purchase, and that gripe water that you mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. these mother's helpers, so to speak, and things of that nature. It's also where we got Jake Leg, which was a horrible condition caused by people drinking an unsafe medicine, which caused a condition where the legs didn't work properly anymore. And that was during the same period with people choosing the medicinal alternatives as a way to get alcohol out of their medicine.
We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Gail is with us in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Oh, this brings back a lot from the past. Oh, there's so many things. One of them that's really hard to find is Rock and Rye. It was a rye whiskey, and it had big chunks of citrus fruit in the bottle. And when you had a cold, you had that. And we used to have that when we were kids, believe it or not, when you really were congested. You just had a little glass of Rock and Rye.
Gail, thank you so much for sharing that. Now, I had Faygo Rock and Rye soda as a kid. This is something different. You write about the Rock and Rye that Gail's talking about, Camper.
I do. And actually, there was beyond Rock and Rye, there were Rock and Rum and Rock and Gin. And the rock refers to rock candy that was used to sweeten them. And there were also minty herbs in there, like horehound was a notable herb, along with the citrus. And they were kind of generally feel-good medicines. What it really is, it's an old fashioned all mixed up together, and you can have that hot or cold, but they were to soothe conditions, particularly with the lungs and coughs and cold and consumption, as it was called, that we know it as tuberculosis today, to soothe those issues. And there are still some commercial rock and rye back on the market today.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Camper English about his new book, Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. Camper, a story just popped into my head from my life. I can't believe I didn't think of this while I was reading it. I'm 9 years old. I have a sore throat and a cough like I often did when I was a kid. My Polish grandparents are over. I'm coughing, clearing my throat. And my grandpa says what he needs is a hooker. And after the shocked silence, he explains, no, he didn't mean I needed a prostitute. A hooker was what they called. It was slang for a shot that you took to, you know, clear out your throat. Have you run across shots of alcohol for 9-year-olds or otherwise as a sore throat cure?
Well, I got to admit, a lot of times before I give a talk or a Zoom interview, I might moisten my throat with a little bit of whiskey for just that reason.
I'll let my bosses know I do not do that on the air. I don't think the FCC allows that. Camper, I want to spend a little time on a really weird period of American health history. The patent medicines, many of which featured alcohol, plus heroin and cocaine and strychnine. Talk about some of the alcohol-laced patent medicines we used to have.
Well, sure. So early whiskey was the alcohol of America. And so we find a lot of whiskey-based medicines in particular. For a while, those were homemade remedies that you'd read about in like West Frontier medicine books. But then they became commercialized products that were heavily advertised and, you know, not always safe, often not safe. And often they didn't treat the things that they were advertised to cure. And so we find a lot of quinine, a lot of mercury, and things like that in these patent medicines. Snake oil was a subcategory of patent medicine. And of course, that's now the name for fake medicines. But snake oil was a particular type of patent medicine supposedly made with rattlesnakes in America. And it may come from a Chinese tradition, but it wasn't really made with snakes. There was just a real shyster behind the famous snake oil, and he got busted later on. And after 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Law in America took care of actually a lot of the false advertisement in medicine, along with false additives in food and false additives and colorants in alcohol. So those were all wrapped up together in this era of the late 1800s of just garbage medicine, garbage alcohol, and garbage food. And that made its way eventually into what became the FDA.
And you mentioned quinine. Now, this is one of the success stories of alcohol and medicine. Quinine, which is in that tonic water, does help with malaria. It's mixed with gin. Why did gin become part of this two-part cure?
Well, I think really the British soldiers were just putting gin in everything as a refreshment. The quinine in the fizzy water comes from the belief that the fizzy water was, in fact, good for you as well. So it was a natural. They put quinine in everything, and it's still in a lot of Italian and French bitter liqueurs on the market today. We only think of it as being in tonic water, but it's in hundreds of products. Alcoholic beverages because of its history treating fevers and malaria in particular. The gin, I think, was really just along for the ride, but the juniper and gin had its own medicinal quantities that it was known for, particularly as a diuretic.
And having gone through the book, Camper, is there a cure you've tried yourself, if I may ask?
I didn't try anything that I haven't tried already, I would say, but I do probably really smart. Sort of believe in digestives a little bit more than I used to and understand that things like gentian that's in those bitters, you can throw a dash of that in with your fizzy water and it not only tastes great, but it might help, you know, speed the digestion a little bit, make you feel a little bit less full, a little bit faster than you did.
Camper, thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Camper English, cocktails and spirits writer and speaker. He was with us today to talk about his new book. It's called Doctors and Distillers, The Remarkable Medicinal History of Beer, Wine, Spirits, and Cocktails. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.